Well, good morning to you. I'm a 10:30 person normally, but all the 8:45 sermons have been recorded and are published, so I've been able to follow along with you as you study the Gospel of John, which has been a real blessing, and it's a privilege to be able to contribute to this ongoing study. We're looking today at John chapter 5, verses 1 to 18. And if you've got Bibles, it'd be good if you could read along with it, or else you can follow it up there. Last week, Stephen taught about a miracle that Jesus did, a healing miracle. And at the end, there's a little comment that this was the second miracle that Jesus had done after returning to Galilee. And John, in his gospel, he counts. He has a number of signs, and we've had number one, number two. This is number three, but he's given up marking them and counting them in the gospel. So you have to count yourself now, but this is number three. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals, and a few weeks ago James explained that men who lived near Jerusalem had to come. It was compulsory to come to the festivals. So Jerusalem was really, really busy at that time, packed out. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Now the Sheep Gate was one of the gates of Jerusalem. It was a walled city, and if you read in Nehemiah, when he started rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, he started at the Sheep Gate. Presumably it was called the Sheep Gate because that's how sheep got into the city. There was this pool surrounded by five covered colonnades, and archaeologists discovered this in the 19th century. They dug up and they found a pool, and it had these porticos or colonnades, both of which are words I don't often use, and I had to look them up. But they're things held up by pillars with kind of archways, they're the same thing. And here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. Now, in the footnote to the Bible, there's this extra bit that says that some manuscripts have some explanation here. They aren't part of what John wrote originally, but as some scribes were copying the Bible, they thought it would be helpful to add this in. It says, they waited for the moving of the waters. From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters, and the first one into the pool after each such disturbance would be cured of whatever disease they had. And I'm guessing it was left out of the Bible because it's probably not true. It sounds like some superstitious nonsense that the pool was spread by a spring and it was probably natural. So I see Bob there. You understand water flow better than most of us here. I doubt that he was an angel of the Lord. And did people really get healed? I don't know. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he'd been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, do you want to get well? And I imagine this must have been a sad sight. I just picture these poor, disabled people lying there, and Jesus is walking among them, and they don't know who he is. If John the Baptist had been there, he'd have said, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. But all these people lying there were just ignorant of who it was that was walking among them. They focused instead on their own misfortune and on their superstition. They were looking for the pool of water to be disturbed rather than looking at someone who could give them life. And this particular one, 38 years he'd been lying. It's hard to envisage 38 years. And some people are defined as victims, aren't they? The worst thing that has ever happened to them is where they find their identity. So maybe he didn't want to be healed. Jesus saying, do you want to be healed? Because if he was healed and he was a beggar, he would lose his livelihood, wouldn't be able to beg anymore. Sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me. So here he is, he in front of him, he has the hope of the world. He can be healed. But his mind is so focused, he thinks the only way he can get healed is to be first into the pool. And I sometimes wonder if we limit the way we expect God to answer our prayers. He can only do things that we've seen him do before or within our understanding. But God can surprise us. As I've been studying John along with you, I've realized that sometimes my prayers are saying, God, I want you to do this, or I want you to do this. And actually, you look at the wedding at Cana, his mother didn't say, Jesus, I want you to change this water into wine. He just says, they have no wine, and leave it to Jesus to work out how he's going to answer. Or in the, we haven't got there yet, but when Lazarus is dead, they don't say, come on, Jesus, come and heal him. They say, Lord, the one you love is ill. Just present the situation to Jesus and see what he does, rather than restricting him to do what we want him or expect him to do. Anyway, Jesus says to the man, get up, pick up your mat and walk. And at once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. So that's a good response, because he could have said, I can't get up and pick up my mat because I'm an invalid. But he obeyed. He chose to obey Jesus, and as a result, he had healing. So it's going well for the guy so far, but that's not the end of the story. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who'd been healed, it's the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat. This man had been miraculously healed. And did the Jewish leaders care about that? No, they were more interested in focusing on the Sabbath rules. But the Sabbath rules forbade people from carrying out their normal occupation on the Sabbath. So unless this guy was a professional mat carrier, which it doesn't say he was, they were probably wrong. The Jews' leaders were so wrong about the point of the Sabbath. You probably know that it was introduced right at the beginning of Genesis. God created the world in 6 days, it says, and then on the seventh day he rested from creation. He doesn't say he was so worn out after 6 days of creation he needed a nap. It says he rested, he stopped creating. And it wasn't because he needed a rest, it's because he knew that we needed regular rest. He was setting a pattern for mankind to follow. He didn't want us to become workaholics working continuously. He wants us from time to time to just rest and enjoy his creation. In Matthew, Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And that's one of the wonderful blessings that God gives us. And immediately after that, he and his disciples stroll through a grain field in the sun, and they're peckish, so they catch some grains of corn, enjoying God's bounty, and they eat it. And the Jews, instead of saying, yes, you're enjoying the Sabbath as God intended, they say, you've got it wrong. You shouldn't be grinding that grain. Anyway, back to this story. He replied, the man who made me well said to me, pick up your mat and walk. So they asked him, who is this fellow? And who told you to pick it up and walk? And the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. He was so happy that he was healed, he didn't actually bother asking the name of the person who'd healed him. Remember, Stephen last week told you about a lady who'd been healed at the Heavenly Wellness Cafe. And when Stephen met her, she was very happy with the healing, but did she want to know about Jesus? No. this spring weather. Are you enjoying the spring weather? There's so many people say, oh, isn't it wonderful, the spring weather? It makes us feel so good. Yes. And what about the God who gave us the spring weather to enjoy? No, not interested. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, see, you're well again. Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. So the physical healing was great, but Jesus is aware that it wasn't the most important thing. He's not just a healer, he's a saviour. And he wants us above all to stop sinning. Sinning is where we live our lives without reference to God, without actually fulfilling what God intended us to do in the world. And the consequence of that is death, something much worse. So he called the man to stop sinning and start living up to his calling to be a reflection of God's character. Now, it's not clear what decision the man made, and perhaps John, who wrote it, didn't know. So the man went away, told the Jewish leaders it was Jesus who'd made him well. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. And in his defense, Jesus said to them, my Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working. And for this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal to God. Let's not believe people who say Jesus did not claim to be God. It's pretty clear he did. Some people say, oh, it's something the disciples made up afterwards. Well, if you believe the Bible, then it's clear that Jesus was claiming to be God by his words and his actions. So that's the story, but what do we learn from it? What's the takeaway? What impact does it make on our lives? Or is it just a bit of Bible knowledge that we can fill our brains with? I was thinking about John, who wrote this. John described himself as the disciple Jesus loved. He was probably the closest of all the disciples, the closest relationship to Jesus. And he is the only one who was not martyred for his faith. So as an old man, he was the only one left, the only person on earth who had a memory of living as part of Jesus's group of disciples, having a front row seat at the most extraordinary events in the history of the world. And as he's old, he lives in Ephesus, and he knows that when he dies, this first-hand account of what Jesus had done would die with him. So he writes. He writes his three epistles, Revelation, and this gospel. And I love the way he starts his first epistle. We proclaim to you the one who existed from the beginning, whom we've heard and seen. We saw him with our own eyes and touched him with our own hands. And I can envisage him in Ephesus telling these stories and people writing them down and saying to him, John, you need to write this down before you pop your clogs. You need to write down this and publish it for posterity. And John in chapter 21, he says, Jesus did so many things. If they're all written down, I suppose the whole world could not contain the books that would be written. But he does write them down. And as he writes them down, he does something quite shocking. He takes Genesis 1, that foundational text from the Jewish scriptures, and he rewrites it into John chapter 1. Shocking. He's saying what's happened is as important as the creation of the cosmos. And then you know in Genesis 1 it's followed by 7 days. Well, in John's gospel there are 7 signs. And this is sign number 3. John chapter 20, he says why he wrote them down. He says Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not in the book, but these are written, one, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and two, that by believing you may have life in his name. And this is the reason John wrote this story, and this is how we need to interpret it and look at it now, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, or go on believing that Jesus is the Messiah, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. John chose seven signs, and they all have a purpose. They all relate to the Old Testament. You don't have to scribble this down. When this is published online on the website, you'll be able to see this particular slide if you want to study it more. The middle one, the seventh sign, is the climax. He actually raised Lazarus from the dead. But this is number three, and it teaches that healing comes from Jesus, not from superstition about angels disturbing waters. And it also leads on to Jesus claiming to be God and Lord of the Sabbath. So what's our response to this? When we hear these stories, when we have an encounter with Jesus, how do people respond? We could choose to remain in despair and hopelessness. We could come to the pool every day for 38 years and say, oh, there's no one to tip me in the water, nothing's only ever get better. Maybe you've got a situation that's been unresolved for 38 years and you've given up on God doing something about it. Maybe you're happy, or you know someone who's happy to play the role of victim because it gives you an identity. We can restrict our expectations of what God can do. He can only do things that I've seen him do before, but no, God can do anything. We might rely on superstition. Yes, we'll go to church, yes, we'll do Christian things, but we'll also cross our fingers from time to time and chuck salt over our shoulder or do other superstitions. So we need to wear our lucky jumper when we've got a big event. So we rely on Jesus, but just in case, we'll have some superstition just to back him up. We can take the gift and ignore the giver. We mentioned people like that. Jesus, later he feeds 5,000 people and they follow him. And he says, you're following me because you want the food, not because you want to follow me. We can build a religion. Sabbath is a wonderful, wonderful gift from God. But the Jews had taken it and sucked all the joy out of it. And they made it, it's what should have been wonderful, became a burden. And I wonder if I sometimes am guilty of that. I know I should read my Bible every day. I should pray. I should attend church. I should volunteer in the church. I should tithe my money. Should. These are all very, very helpful things to my spiritual development. But once they become shoulds, they become a religion rather than being a disciple of Jesus. The song we've sang this morning has the line, I'm sorry, Lord, for the thing I've made it. And I must admit, I have never understood that line, and I always stopped singing when I got to it. But this morning, I finally understood it. That I have taken my following of Jesus and I've made it into a religion sometimes. So this morning I sang it for the first time. Boo. So we can do all those things, or we can encounter God and do nothing about it. Because Jesus healed this man, but then said, you've got to stop sinning. In a few weeks you'll read about a woman who was, Jesus saved her from a mob who wanted to stone her. And that's great. But Jesus then said, now leave your life of sin. Go and sin no more. And I've come across people who've experienced wonderful blessings from Jesus. They've enjoyed it, but they haven't changed as a result. They've just continued with their old life. But we don't have to do any of those, because we could do what John offers us. He says there's a path out of despair, superstition, oppressive religion, and sin. And we can achieve what John wanted to achieve when he wrote these things down. That we could believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, have life in Jesus' name. So there's a path from despair into life. And in John 10:10, Jesus describes this life as life in all its fullness. And that's what we have the privilege of enjoying as disciples of Jesus.